I hope this is a helpful theme for us this afternoon. I think there is something to thinking about the book of Ecclesiastes, technology that surrounds us, and this idea of control that I think is helpful, and I've been sort of finding my way into it in my own Christian life, so I hope it will be a help to us. As we get going, I want us to think about what we've been learning so far in Ecclesiastes, and to think about that theme of control. What has Ecclesiastes taught us so far about how much is under our control? So, around tables, just discuss that for a few minutes. What comes to mind? All right, let's see what you came up with then. So, what has Ecclesiastes taught us so far about how much is under our control? Not a lot. And is that... so not a lot of control. And just any kind of texture to that or things that have struck you? Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. So we mustn't come away from Ecclesiastes thinking that it is purely saying you have no control at all. Just let the river take you wherever it's going to take you. No, it's got some part for us considering, reflecting our ways, and wisdom is going to be more and more a theme of the book as we go a bit further on. No one's got yet to chapter 11, but it's going to talk about the wisdom of recognizing how you don't quite know how things are going to turn out. So, start of chapter 11, ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in 7 ventures, yes, in 8. You do not know what disaster will come upon the land. So, have a diverse portfolio. Invest broadly because you don't know how things are going to turn out. There's a wisdom in that. Later on, sow your seed in the morning. At evening, let your hands not be idle, for you don't know which will succeed, whether this or that. So there's going to be a call just not to being idle, but to taking responsibility and exercising at one level, control over the things that you can control. Sowing your seeds, not being idle, and that kind of thing. So there'll be some of those things coming through Ecclesiastes as well. Okay, we'll come back to Ecclesiastes a bit more, I think, as we go on. Let's think about technology as an effort to control the world. That might be one way that we could define what technology is. You're trying to do things with things in the world. And as we're trying to frame this series, we want to recognize technology then is both a good gift and can be used and misused very badly. But just to put the positive case early, let's recognize that technology is an effort to control the world for the better. God gives human beings a measure of control and responsibility over the world. So when we hear God speaking to Adam and Eve in Genesis 1, you've got the verses there on your handout. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So there's a degree there to which exercising dominion is an appropriate thing to be doing. And so thinking, how do we care for, how do we provide, how do we facilitate the fruitfulness of the world? That takes skill and that takes technology. This is the world of farming and much more besides. And so when we are sometimes tempted to talk about how with technology we mustn't play God, Genesis 1 actually says, no, that's the human calling. We're actually called to play God in the world, to image him, to be his representatives, to embody the same love of creation and care for it that he has demonstrated in creation. So there's a positive way in which we ought to be imaging God in the world, playing him, representing him. That's the human calling. But as we know, there are all sorts of ways in which we don't care for this world or try and exert control and exercise dominion over the world in ways that are good. As I've been reading around this, there's one particular phrase that gets really picked up right the way through the 20th century. You'll find it in First World War poetry, Siegfried Sassoon. You'll find it in E.M. Forster. If you're used to thinking of E.M. Forster as sort of period dramas, Howard's End and Passage to India, he's also got a fascinating short story called The Machine Stops, written in 40s or 50s. And he's describing this future where everyone is now separated in these little cubicles where food is delivered to them and entertainment is delivered to them by the machine. It's remarkably futuristic. He basically describes Zoom, as far as I can tell, decades before it actually happened. And people just relate to each other on these screens. And the poet D.H. Lawrence, George Orwell, T.S. Eliot, they all talk about the machine as something that characterizes the kind of modern age. The way that the modern world, with an increase of technology, has become a bit more dehumanizing in the things that they just see that machines can do to people. This is the generations of the First and Second World War, but also of kind of increased industrialization and the way that the machines become useful to us, but also we become there to kind of service the machines and keep them working. And so they take on a kind of an enslaving and a destructive sort of character. So it's a really broad theme across a lot of literature in the last 100 years or so. It's also something that appears in Tolkien, and this is obviously coming a little bit closer to home with a slightly more theological view of the world. He wrote a letter to describe what is the Lord of the Rings all about. And if anyone's not read any Lord of the Rings, here's what he says it's all about. All this stuff is mainly concerned with fall, mortality, and the machine. By the last, I intend all use of external plans or devices, apparatus, instead of the development of the inherent inner powers or talents, or even the use of these talents with the corrupt motive of dominating, bulldozing the real world, and coercing other wills. He's talking about the way that the machine technology can, instead of helping develop the world's natural fruitfulness and kind of working with the grain of the world, instead, sort of these external plans or contraptions do things to the world. So this idea that we start doing things to the world rather than doing things with the world, and living a little more in harmony with creation. That's his big idea. Or it might be that we actually work with creation, but we do that to dominate the world or others. That last line is kind of interesting. He says, the machine is our more obvious modern form, though more closely related to magic than is usually recognized. Modern machinery and industrialization and magic. In our minds, we imagine those are very, very far apart, don't we? We think magic belongs to sort of medieval or ancient world, and now we're very modern and very technological. But Tolkien and others are going to say, no, there's something quite similar to them. There is something quite similar to them in the ways that we are trying to exert control over the world. Instead of doing the kind of hard work and careful work of caring for creation, instead, we're just trying to do things to the world. That's a thought that C.S. Lewis picks up as well. So this is from his Abolition of Man. As far as I can tell, he doesn't use the phrase the machine, but he talks about something very, very similar in this quote. There is something which unites magic and applied science technology while separating them from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men and women of old, the cardinal problem of human life was how to conform the soul to objective reality, and the solution was wisdom, self-discipline, and virtue. For the modern, the cardinal problem is how to conform reality to the wishes of man, and the solution is a technique. So again, let's just pause because there's a lot going on there. He's saying there are two modern things that you meet. There's this idea of magic, and there's the idea of applied science technology. And they both represent a kind of new wave. The older way of thinking about the world was that what we are trying to do is conform ourselves to reality, to recognize that there are limits that we live within, and so to live with wisdom and self-discipline and virtue. But the modern mindset says, no, what we must do is basically change the world to make it accommodate us, and we must conform reality to our wishes. And he says, you see the same spirit at work, both in magic, and a lot of people in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries got very excited in magic again because they thought maybe there's a way to exert power in the world through magic, and through technology. It's the same thing. What we are trying to do is to fix reality, to transform it, to conform it to our wishes, rather than recognizing any limits to what we can control. So lots of people suggesting that there is more and more in the modern world an unhealthy relationship with technology where we are treating it as a way of conforming reality to what we want. And part of that concern is the way that we exploit the world, and our relationship to the world is slightly changed here. There's a brilliant example of that in The Lord of the Rings. There's a moment where Treebeard, who is effectively a living tree, is reflecting on this wizard, Saruman. Saruman was supposed to be a friend of the trees and a guardian of the forests, but he's become corrupted. And here's what Treebeard has to say about Saruman. He is plotting to become a power. He has a mind of metal and wheels, and he does not care for growing things, except as far as they serve him for the moment. So that idea of relating to the world, to impose ourselves on it, to dominate it, and to make it useful to us, rather than living more in harmony with it. Now, obviously, that sort of approach, you can find some extreme examples and some fairly scary futures. If we're thinking about a lot of the transhumanist debate, then these are people suggesting that, yes, quite soon human beings will be able to live without these limits that we currently exist in, and we'll be able to control all kinds of things that at the moment still limit us, even up to including death. People are talking about the hopes of somehow transforming the human situation, either giving bodies that don't break down or constantly renewing them. Did you catch that clip a little while ago? It was Putin discussing with the Chinese president, Xi, and also the leader of North Korea. And I think it was the Chinese president who was saying, guys, very soon we're going to be able to live to 150. Because there'll basically be a constant supply of organ transfers. And so we will just be able to receive new organs and so live to 150. And you wonder, whose organs? And did they volunteer for that? The way that some of these things go is very dark and pretty scary. One of the things that C.S. Lewis liked to point out was that when we talk about human beings getting control over the world, what it really means is some people getting control and being able to advantage themselves. Brings us back to Ecclesiastes for a moment. Can anyone tell me which movie begins with that clip from Ecclesiastes at the top of the handout? Consider God's handiwork, who can straighten what he hath made crooked. What movie begins with that on screen? It's the movie Gattaca, a bit of an old 90s movie now, but it's a movie that describes a future when parents can screen their children and work out whether they are likely to do well in life and can pay for them to be upgraded and for their faults to be screened out. It's a film really all about that question of how much can we control through science? Where will we get to with that? There are some pretty scary ways that people want to take some of these thoughts into the future. But I did want to think about the way that this desire to make life controllable actually surrounds us. It is a very present and a very inescapable thing. And to help us with that, I've been reading this book recently. It's called The Uncontrollability of the World by a guy called Hartmut Rosa. He's a German professor of sociology, not a Christian as far as I can tell, but he's reflecting on the modern world and how much we try and exert control over it. You got a couple of quotes from him on your handouts now. He says, the mantra of modern life is that our life will be better if we manage to bring more world within our reach. And by within our reach, he means really kind of under our grasp, under our belt, how much we can conquer, how much we can master. That's the sort of language that he knows we use all the time to think about how we might relate to the world. So the mantra of modern life, that our life will be better if we manage to bring more world within our reach. In another place, he describes modernity as driven towards making the world calculable, manageable, predictable, and controllable in every possible respect. On your tables, I'd love you just to have a go at thinking, can we see that at all in modern life? So can you think of areas of life or examples of technological advances where that's true, and where we are trying to make the world more calculable, that we can kind of calculate it, we can predict it, manageable, predictable, controllable? And let's come down to that kind of smartphone question. How, in some ways, is the smartphone an embodiment of that desire? Well, let's take 5 to 10 minutes over this. All right. Let's see how you got on. Can you then, can you think of areas of life or examples of technological advances where you can see this at work, this desire to make the world as controllable as possible in every respect? What came to mind? Yeah, thank you. I think that's one of the places where you can see the advance of technology has given the opportunity for a level of control that most human beings for most of human history just haven't had. And so that ability to control, not just whether we have children, but when we have children, how many children we have, what sort of children, we're not far off, I think, just that level of consumerism in the ways that we think about the creation of children. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, fantastic. So a really great place to see this is when something goes wrong, just the natural assumption is, well, this ought to have been under our control. This must have been somebody's responsibility. These things don't just happen, and somebody's responsible. So yeah, great. Really good example. Thank you. Yeah. No, that's great. I think we do. We start to relate to reality as if there's some sort of implicit contract. I've got the information, and therefore this is how the day should go, and this is how the weather should be. Yeah. And picture the hypothetical parent of teenagers saying to them, "You should possibly take a coat or an umbrella out today, but I've checked the weather apps and it's not going to rain." You don't know that. Why not take a coat? Hypothetically speaking. Other examples coming up around the tables? Yeah. A couple of others that come to mind. That the sort of smart home idea, the idea that, from your home, you can now, wherever you are, turn on the heating, check who's at the door, check what's in the fridge, determine how hot the shower gets, turn the lights on, water the garden. And as you read what some of those apps are saying, it's not just the moment when you've left the home and you're thinking, oh, did I remember to turn the light off? But it's also, don't worry, you just don't have to get up from your chair to do any of these things. You're actually in your home, but don't worry, you can do it with a finger and a click rather than actually taking some work in that. The desire and the illusion of having a home that is utterly controllable, that everything can be set and pre-programmed and done remotely, it's sort of playing into that desire that my own little bit of the world, I'd love it to be as controllable as that. Health apps would be another big example, I think, where the amount of medical data that you can now have available to you with rings and wristbands and watches and different things that are going to monitor your health. Probably there is a kind of ongoing, sort of increasing sort of illusion of I've therefore got a good picture of what my health is, and I'm therefore in some way sort of guaranteed good health. The amount of knowledge that that we gain, the amount of data that's available to us is pretty high. There was one really striking example of how control relates to health in this book on Ecclesiastes. It describes a lady called Kate Bowler, who, 35 years old, married with a young son, and then is diagnosed with stage 4 stomach cancer. And she describes what it is to be age 35 and to have that diagnosis. And she describes some of the conversations that people have with her and her reflections on it. She says this, "Control is a drug, and we're all hooked. Whether or not we believe in the prosperity gospel's assurance that we can master the future with our words and attitudes, I can barely admit to myself that I have almost no choice but to surrender, but neither can those around me. I hear it in my sister-in-law's voice as she tells me to keep fighting. I can see it in my academic friends. When do the symptoms start, they ask? Is it hereditary? Buried in all their concern is the unspoken question, do I have any control? Is there something that you did that led to that and I can avoid it? Or is there something that can tell me it probably won't happen to me because it's just hereditary and something like that? That kind of desire for control and the thought that technology and what it can tell us can give us more control than we have. Let's press on a little bit with our new friend, Hartmut Rosa. And he describes what happens when you have a society that tries to exercise that level of control over life. What happens? The first is that we certainly don't gain control. In lots of ways, we lose control. You might like to ask at a different point whether a smartphone actually makes you feel more in control or less in control. That you can work out where other members of your family are in Find My or whatever else. Does that make you feel more in control or not? You can reflect on that. But I think we can end up feeling actually a loss of control in a few different ways. Firstly, because we rely more on technology to do things for us that we would ordinarily be able to do for ourselves. So one writer speaks about how each new machine means that something we previously mastered with the help of our organic intellectual equipment, in other words, your brain, but also your hands and your body, is now left to a technical construct. What do you mean by that? Well, cars that just require us to do so much less thinking and planning is one big feature of that, I think, where there are all sorts of things that we used to do. The skills of judgment about when to brake, how safe is it to turn here, all those sorts of things. Technology is increasingly taking over a lot of that decision-making for us. Or one of the more corrosive things about AI is its offer to do the thinking for you. And so instead of thinking, how would I take this article and boil it down to 3 points? And to do that, I'm going to need to exercise judgment. I'm going to need to think carefully. I'm going to need to weigh up this idea against this idea and understand something of the author and why this one might actually be more important to them. Maybe it gets a bit less space, but it's more important. It's doing more work in the chapter. Whereas these other points are doing less work. There's an awful lot of skill and wisdom in doing that work for ourselves and learning to make those sorts of judgments. And technologies are at risk of taking some of those things away from us, taking away the sort of skills that we have. And so actually being able to exercise less control. Then we ought to ask, what control do they actually give us? Where, as we've said, to be able to know who's at the door or where my children are, that's helpful to some degree, but it doesn't give me any meaningful control over keeping them safe wherever it is that they are. That all of those apps that offer us control over everything that's happening at home, well, apps crash and they break and systems get hacked and power goes down and actually all of those things that seem to offer limitless control can leave us logged out, offline, and not able to do very basic things. As we touched on, I think, in the first or second session of this series, there is the way that technology offering control can actually just end up controlling us to a fairly significant degree. So that thought that we are the product and these devices, particularly some of these apps, are designed to control us and to keep us online and to grab our attention. Another writer, Byung-Chul Han, who's a Korean philosopher, really fascinating guy, again, not a Christian, but writing a lot about the dangers of a society that gets fixated on these things. He says there's no fundamental difference between being reachable at all times and being enslaved. The smartphone is a mobile labor camp in which we voluntarily intern ourselves. Doesn't have to be, but it often can be. So we don't actually gain all that much control for all that's promised. But then the most striking thing, and I think one of the things I've most learned from this guy, Rosa, is that in the end we actually lose the world. And we want to control the world and bring it into our reach, but actually we lose it. And what do we mean by that? In what sense do we lose the world? Firstly, I think there's just a sense that we're distanced from it. If the robot mower is programmed to go out and mow the lawn once a week for you, then you are not in your garden. You're not actually in amongst the lawn. You're not noticing whether the butterflies have arrived yet this summer or not, or what it is that they're feeding off. You're not really looking at the state of your lawn and the number of dandelions and things that are growing there. You're just not in contact with the world through some of these things. We lose that. It's mediated to us, and we ask technology to look after the world for us. So we're distanced from the world in that way. It becomes something that we treat as useful to us. That's what Treebeard was bothered about with Saruman, if you remember. He's only thinking about what is useful to him. We look at the world purely as materials and resources to be extracted and used, rather than thinking of ourselves as part of that world. And as caretakers of it rather than exploiters of it. But most particularly, this guy Rosa wants to point out two things to us. The first is that he says the world becomes a point of aggression. That's his phrase, a point of aggression. What he means by that is if you are coming to the world with the desire to control it, then you will experience it as something that resists you, that is fighting against you, and you need to win. You need to beat it. You need to conquer it. And so the more that we want to try and exert control over life, and the more that we're actually going to feel that we are in a battle with it, that there is conflict here, there is frustration. And sometimes I think we do see that borne out in our own lives when we just think the world should work and it is frustrating to us and we kick things. Because we're really frustrated. It should just work. And we've bought into this idea that there's more control over it than we can experience. So he wants to point out it. You actually, by trying to gain the world and take control of it, you actually lose it. It starts moving away from you, and your relationship to it becomes slightly more hostile. But then, lastly, I think most helpfully, he wants to talk about the need to experience what is uncontrollable in life. It's only in encountering the uncontrollable that we really experience the world. Only then do we feel touched, moved, alive. So he talks about all of the real deep joys of life coming from moments when you're not really in control. He talks about snow. That's why the front cover of the book is a picture of snow. He just wants you to remember that delightful childhood moment when snow starts falling. Did you cause it to come? No. Did it thrill you with a sense of gift and wonder? Of course it did. You couldn't predict it. You couldn't control it. It just came. Or Wimbledon final. That's not his example, but he talks about sporting events. Let's just think particularly about that. What is the thrill of watching the Wimbledon final? A good part of it is not knowing how it's going to end. And it goes down to the tiebreaker in the fifth set. And the thrill and the joy of it is just not knowing, not being in control, not knowing how that will end. It's him that talks about the world as not really owning a dog, but owning a cat. I know lots of dogs aren't well behaved, but that thought that we don't treat reality as a dog to be trained so that it rolls over when we tell it to, but instead life being more spontaneous than that and unpredictable than that and more delightful than that. He speaks about that song that you don't know why it has that effect on you, but when you go to the concert and the first chords strike up of that thing, it's just hairs on the back of the neck and you're transported back to when you were 17 and you first heard that song or whatever it is. But those moments that are just utterly uncontrollable, you can't buy those. But they are magical. They are what happens when you embrace something that is uncontrollable but wonderful. Love. That sense that you are in a relationship with somebody, a friend, a romantic relationship, whatever it is. But here is somebody whose beauty to you is precisely the fact that they're not utterly under your control. If they were that kind of robot or AI bride or groom or the robotic dog or the robotic cat that will just always be there for you, There's something so artificial about that and so controlled about that that it's just dead, isn't it? But those relationships where there is genuinely something that you can't control, that's where we experience the world. That's where life actually happens. Now, as I say, he's not a Christian as far as I can tell, but boy, is he onto something. And, you know, can't we help him see just what that is? That as Ecclesiastes teaches us, each of these things are things that are going to come into our lives as a gift to enjoy, precisely the things that we can't control. And of course, with all of those comes the kind of friction of life. It won't always snow on Christmas Day. Wimbledon final, sometimes it won't be the person that we're cheering for that wins. Or you pay the crews to go and see the Northern Lights and they just don't show up. That's, again, life is just not predictable in that way. You don't pay your money and get what you paid for. But when those moments come, they're a delight. And we know they're a gift from our Creator. They're a gift from His hand that we enjoy. So I think it's a wonderful book that teaches us to resist that temptation, particularly through technology, but through all sorts of other things, to think that we can exert control over the world and our lives would be better if we could exert total control. Let's just ask a couple of questions around tables as we finish. What do you think that means for our engagement with the digital world? What kinds of principles should guide our use of technology then in light of the kinds of things that we've thought about this afternoon? Why don't I just chew that over for a few moments around tables, and then we'll turn to prayer. All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Great to see you. Look forward to seeing you next week, or indeed, prayer meeting Thursday, 7:45 in here. Lovely. Thanks, everyone.